We are discussing Jacob, which is F on your class outline sheet. And we were in the middle of number 2 under Jacob, the years at Haran, which is Genesis 29 through 31. The end of the last hour, we had noted that when Jacob arrived in Haran and met Laban, he entered into an agreement with Laban that he'd work for 7 years in order to receive Rachel as his wife, who was the younger of Laban's two daughters. And the time comes for the marriage after the 7 years, and he's given Leah instead of Rachel. And that's about the point where we stopped to close at the last hour. But you notice in verse 26 of chapter 29, Laban said, "It must not be so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Fulfill her week, and we will give thee this also for the service which thou shalt serve with me yet 7 other years. So Jacob did so and fulfilled her week, and he gave him Rachel, his daughter, as his wife also. Now, again, you're in a cultural context that is quite different from what we are familiar with. It's hard for us, I think, to imagine, let alone having two wives, have two wives within 1 week with whom they're sisters. And that, of course, presented enormous difficulties internally in Jacob's family. Now, I think it's quite clear that that's what happened, that it's within the week that he receives Rachel as the second wife, because you notice that after the birth of Joseph, which follows in the next chapter, you are at the end of the second 7 years of service, because he had to serve another 7 years subsequent to receiving Rachel. And you see, you read in verse 25 of chapter 30, "Came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said unto Laban, send me away that I may go to my own place and to my country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served thee, and let me go, for thou knowest my service which I have done. And Laban said, I pray thee, if I have found favor in thy eyes, tarry, for I have learned by experience that the Lord hath blessed me for thy sake." And then they negotiate a continued arrangement where he stays. But at the end of that second period of service, he has already 11 or 12 children that have come to him, not only by Leah, but by the handmaids of Leah and of Rachel. Now we'll go back and pick up that in a minute. The procedure of marrying sisters is explicitly forbidden in the Mosaic Law. If you go to Leviticus 18:18, you read, "Neither shalt thou take a wife to her sister, to vex her, to uncover her nakedness, besides the other in her lifetime." So when you get to the Mosaic Law, that specific kind of situation is addressed, and it's forbidden. But of course, at this point in time, it's long before the Mosaic Law has been given. And Jacob takes two sisters as wives. Now certainly, even at this time, it conflicts with the creation ordinance of monogamy. We discussed that earlier when we discussed the early chapters of Genesis. It seems clearly in Genesis that God intended for man to have one wife, and monogamy was the intent. But we find that Jacob does this. Misery is the result. Because look at verse 30 as you pick up the narrative. "He went in also unto Rachel, and he loved Rachel more than Leah, and served with him yet 7 other years. And then verse 31, "When the Lord saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren." So Leah conceives, and you have the firstborn son to Jacob, who is Reuben, who is the son of Leah. And you find that in verse 32. And you notice the comment of Leah when Reuben is born. She says, surely the Lord hath looked upon my affliction. Now therefore my husband will love me. You have this competition between Leah and Rachel for the love of Jacob. And Leah feels, now Jacob will love me. Then 33, she conceived again and bore a son and said, because the Lord hath heard that I was hated, he hath given me this son also. And she called his name Simeon. So there's the second child. And verse 34, she conceived again and bore a son and said, now this time will my husband become attached unto me, because I've borne him three sons. Therefore was his name called Levi. And she conceived again and bore a son and said, now will I praise the Lord. Therefore she called his name Judah and ceased bearing. But there are four sons born to Leah. Rachel is still barren. And in connection with the birth of these sons, it becomes very clear that there's a struggle going on between Rachel and Leah for the love of Jacob. The next strategy of Rachel to overcome her barrenness is to give her handmaid to Jacob, much as Sarah did Hagar to Abraham. So you read in the early part of chapter 30, when Rachel saw she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister, still of this competition, and said unto Jacob, give me children or else I die. And Jacob's anger was kindled, and he said, am I in God's stead? Who hath withheld from thee the fruit of the womb? So then she says, behold my maid, Bilhah, go in unto her. Bilhah conceives, and you have a fifth child born to Jacob, and that's Dan, down in verse 6. And then in verse 7, Bilhah conceives again. And notice the comment of Rachel then. With great, in verse 8, with great wrestlings have I wrestled with my sister, and I have prevailed. And she called his name Naphtali. Even though it wasn't her own direct seed, through her handmaiden, she feels a certain victory over Leah. Now, when Leah saw that she had ceased bearing, verse 9, she takes Zilpah, her maid, gave her Jacob as his wife, and a seventh son is born, Gad, Zilpah, Leah's maid. And then Zilpah bears another son, verse 13, who was Asher, that's the eighth son. And then the strategy of Rachel in verses 14 and following is this. You read that Reuben, who was the firstborn of Leah, went in the days of wheat harvest and found mandrakes in the field and brought them unto his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, give me, I pray thee, of thy son's mandrakes. And she said unto her, is it a small matter that thou hast taken my husband? Wouldst thou take away my son's mandrakes also? And Rachel said, therefore he shall lie with thee tonight for thy son's mandrakes. And Jacob came out of the field in the evening, and Leah went out to meet him and said, thou must come in unto me, for surely I have hired thee with my son's mandrakes. And he lay with her that night. Now, it's believed, or it was believed in that time, that these mandrakes, which was a certain kind of plant, it was apparently hard to find, was believed that that had properties that would increase fertility and conception. And there's some dispute about exactly what it was. There may have been some validity to it. But you find what happens in this instance is, Rachel thinks if she can get these mandrakes, she's going to have a child, and so she bargains that way with Reuben. But Leah then says, I've hired thee with my son's mandrakes. And you read in verse 17, God hearkened unto Leah. She conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. So that it becomes the occasion of increasing Leah's advantage, you might say. But the thing that's clear through this whole narrative is this struggle between Leah and Rachel. But finally, you read down in verse 22, after Leah is conceived again, in verse 22, you read, and God remembered Rachel. And God hearkened to her and opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. She called his name Joseph and said, the Lord shall add to me another son. You remember, of course, later in these patriarchal narratives, Joseph is the favorite son. And that is the son of Rachel, whom Jacob loved and was the one that was born at the end of this long process. But I think what we see in this process, in spite of all the connivings and difficulties, you see that God is working to give the seed. There's that promise to Abraham, to Isaac, repeated to Jacob. And here at Haran, you have the initial fulfillment of the promise of the great seed. Leah has the children immediately. Rachel does not have any for some time. As far as that continuation of the line of promise is concerned, Leah is the one who has the honor of becoming the progenitor of the tribe of Judah, because Judah was the son of Leah. And as we'll see when we trace this further, that line of promise ultimately narrows to the tribe of Judah. Of course, out of the tribe of Judah, it narrows further to the house of David, eventually. But this just is a chart. I can't get it all on there, I guess. Of the sons that are born to Jacob by Leah. You see there on the left side, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Dina, daughter. And then by Bilhah, Dan and Naphtali. Bilhah is Rachel's servant, handmaid. And then Zilpah, which is Leah's handmaid, is Gad and Asher. And then Rachel, Joseph, and later Benjamin. That's not till chapter 35:18, I guess. Yeah. See, in chapter 35, Benjamin is born, and Rachel dies in childbirth at that time. So Genesis 35:18-19, not in Haran, but later Benjamin is born. Now, of course, the other thing is that before the death of Jacob, after Joseph has gone down into Egypt and Jacob has eventually followed with the family, he adopts the two sons of Joseph. And that's Ephraim and Manasseh, you see, Joseph's two sons. In Genesis 46, you find that those two sons are adopted and given an equal status with the sons of Jacob. So that's where you get the 12 tribes, because you see, Ephraim and Manasseh are really grandsons of Jacob. But if you turn there just for a minute to Genesis 46:20, and unto Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potiphar, priest of On, bore to him. So those two sons are born, and over in Genesis 48, you find that at the point just before Jacob is to die, Joseph brings Ephraim and Manasseh to Jacob. Jacob says in verse 5, "Now thy two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born unto thee in the land of Egypt, before I came to thee into Egypt, are mine." That's Jacob saying that. "As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. And thy issue which thou begettest after them shall be thine, and shall be called after the name of their brethren in their inheritance," so forth. And then what he does later on in that chapter is bless Ephraim and Manasseh. And it's very interesting what happens at that point. You read that in verse 13, "Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right hand." See, they're facing each other. "And Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it upon Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand upon Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn." In other words, Joseph arranged it so that the right hand would go out and be on Manasseh, and his left hand on Ephraim. What Jacob does is crosses his arms and does it the other way. And you read in verse 17, when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand upon the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, and he held up his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head unto Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this is the firstborn. Put thy right hand upon his head." And his father refused and said, "I know it, my son, I know it. He also shall become a people, and he shall also be great." But truly, and here you get this principle, you see, that we've seen time and time again. His younger brother will be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations. And he blessed them that day, saying, "In thee shall Israel bless, saying, God hath made thee as Ephraim and Manasseh." And he set Ephraim before Manasseh. So he really gave Ephraim the right of the firstborn, you might say. He was going to be greater than his brother, even though he was the secondborn. And, of course, you see that later in the history of Israel. Ephraim becomes the prominent tribe of the north, so prominent, in fact, that often the north is called Ephraim. But Ephraim and Manasseh then are ultimately included in these children of Jacob by that means, where Jacob adopts them as his own children. Yeah.
Why do they not speak of Levi as a tribe after that happened?
Well, there are different ways of counting the tribes. They do, but I think the thing to remember is,
like 13.
Yeah, but the thing to remember is Levi did not get a portion of the land. When the land was divided up by Joshua, the land was divided into the 12 tribes.
But then when you look at Revelation, and you have the 12 apostles, what will be the 12 tribes?
What will be
the Joseph and Levi, or will it be?
It's hard to say. Often in the enumerations that you find in later times, Simeon sort of seems to get absorbed into Judah in the south and almost disappear. Now, whether that's part of the answer to your question, I think it's hard to say. It depends on how you count them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they can be counted in different ways. But the 12 tribes that received inheritance.
So you're saying there's some ambiguity there.
Yeah.
That there's not a consensus among.
No. And even in Scripture, when it speaks of the 12 tribes and enumerates them, you get differences in the way in which they are enumerated later. Now, I can't trace that out, but you find that in later references, the 12 tribes. You get it at the time of the division between the north and the south, where it says there are 10 tribes in the north and 2 in the south. And then you try to list the 10 and the 2, and it becomes complicated at that point. Because Benjamin seems to be in the south, certainly Judah's in the south. What do you do then with Simeon? Maybe Simeon is absorbed into Judah at that point and doesn't really count. That's what some people think. But it's true. You've got 13 here altogether, counting Levi. Okay. Well, we noticed, to get back to Jacob at Haran, after the birth of these sons is described in chapter 30, we find that Jacob agrees to stay longer with Laban. And over a period of time, he increases his possessions a great deal. That begins to lead to trouble with Laban's household. And the Lord then tells Jacob to leave. In chapter 31, verse 11, you read, "The angel of God spoke unto me in a dream, saying, Jacob, and I said, Here am I. And he said, Lift up now thine eyes and see all the rams which leap upon the cattle, or striped, speckled, and spotted, for I have seen all that Laban doeth unto thee. I am the God of Bethel, where thou anointest the pillar, and where thou vowedest a vow unto me. Now arise, get thee out from this land, and return unto the land of thy kindred." So the Lord tells Jacob to return, and he speaks to his wives about that. They agree. And when Laban goes away to shear sheep some distance away, Jacob gathers his family and his possessions, and without telling Laban, he packs up and leaves. And in addition, Rachel takes, in 31:19, the images that were her father's. Now, term there is teraphim. They were household idols of some sort. The specific use to which they were put is somewhat disputed. But in any case, Rachel took them. And you read verse 20, Jacob stole away unawares to Laban the Syrian, and that he told him not that he left. Laban comes back, finds out that he's gone. He's very upset. And he sets out after Jacob. And he seems that he is particularly upset because he is missing his household idols. And many feel from newsy documents that there was connected with possession of those idols rights of inheritance. And that Laban was fearful that Jacob had taken them, and that sometime later he'd come back and claim all of Laban's possessions, so that he had the rights to it by possession of these things. Now, whether that's the case or not, that's somewhat reading between the lines. But you find that Laban does pursue, and he catches up with Jacob. Verse 26, Laban said to Jacob, "What hast thou done? That thou hast stolen away unawares to me, and carried away my daughters as captives, taken by the sword. Wherefore didst thou flee away secretly?" So forth. He said, "I would have sent you away with mirth and with feast," and kissed his sons and his daughters goodbye, and so forth. And then down verse 30, he says, "Wherefore hast thou stolen my gods?" Now Jacob was completely unaware that Rachel had done that. And so he says, verse 31, "Because I was afraid, for I said, perhaps thou wouldst take by force thy daughters from me. With whomsoever you find the gods, let him not live. Before our brethren, discern now what is thine with me, take it to thee." For Jacob knew not that Rachel had stolen it. Laban begins to search for these idols. And you read in verse 33, he went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two maidservants. He found nothing. After he came out of Leah's tent, he entered Rachel's tent. And you read in verse 34, "Now Rachel had taken the household gods and had put them inside the camel's saddle and was sitting on it. Laban searched through everything in the tent but found nothing. Rachel said to her father, 'Don't be angry, my lord, that I cannot stand up in your presence. I am having my period.'" Now, I'm reading that from the NIV. The King James what verse is that? 35. "For the custom of women is upon me." Well, maybe that's an Elizabethan English way of saying that. But I don't think it'd be very well understood by most people today. I think the NIV is saying what she said. And she used that to keep him from looking in that saddle. So he never does discover the idol. But the dispute is settled by the conclusion of a covenant between Jacob and Laban. And the essence of that is, they set up this heap of stones. Notice verse 48. Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me today." That is why it was called Galeed. It was also called Mizpah, because he said, "May the Lord keep watch between you and me when we are away from each other. If you mistreat my daughters, or if you take any wives besides my daughters, even though there is no one with us, remember that God is witness between you and me." And then he said, "This heap is witness," verse 32 or 52, "and this pillar is a witness that I will not go past this heap to your side to harm you. You will not go past the heap and pillar to my side to harm me." And it seems to me that this idea of possession of these idols in connection with inheritance rights may explain that provision of this arrangement. You're not going to cross this boundary anymore to my harm. And Jacob agrees to that, and Laban agrees to that, and they depart in peace, having concluded that agreement. Now, just one comment on verse 49, which is sometimes called Jacob's blessing, or benediction. It was called Mizpah because he said, "May the Lord keep watch between you and me when we are away from each other." You often see that verse quoted in a very positive way. In a context, it's really a curse formula. You see, what he's saying is, the Lord is witness to this, and if you violate this covenant, may God's wrath be on you. That's the implication of that statement. And of course, the other sentiment that, taken out of context, is certainly very legitimate and very true. Certainly can be a blessing, but it's not the sense or meaning in the context of that statement. Question? Well,
yeah. Why Rachel died in
Oh, I see. I don't know. I'd hesitate to make that connection. I would certainly think that Jacob put his own integrity on the line when he said that. If you find somebody, he would. Doesn't say to use the name of the Lord. And there's not an oath formula there. But certainly his own integrity would be on the line to let Laban take the life of anyone whom he found with those idols. But whether you could say that it goes beyond that and relates to death, I'd be hesitant about that. So they make that covenant, and then they depart in peace. Okay, any questions or comments on the years at Haran, 29 through 31? Well, you know it was 14 years plus. I don't think you can settle how many years beyond that. It must have been a time beyond that, because subsequent to that second 7 years, they negotiate several times different arrangements. And every time it works to Jacob's advantage, where he keeps increasing his cattle as compared to Laban. So, you know, it takes some time to do that. It wouldn't seem to me unlikely that you're talking 20 years.
And this is in the territory generally occupied by the Amalek.
Probably was. So it's right near the Euphrates, to the north. All right, let's go on to 3. Jacob at Peniel, Genesis 32. I think up to this point, we've seen that God has blessed Jacob in spite of his character and in spite of his sins. But at this point in his life, as he is returning to Canaan, God uses Jacob's fear of Esau to work in Jacob's own life. And that happens at a place that's called Peniel. That term comes from Genesis 32:30, where you read, Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It's because I saw God face to face." Peniel really means the face of God. And he has an experience there that causes him to give the place that name. Now, the background for that is that while Jacob has been away, Esau has become powerful. Remember, he initially left home because Esau had sworn to kill him. And Rebecca was fearful that Esau would carry that out. So she wanted Jacob away. I think the NIV note, or the NIV study Bible note, it says, "Small portable idols which Rachel probably stole because she thought they would bring her protection and blessing, or perhaps she wanted to have something tangible to worship on the long journey ahead, a practice referred to much later in the writings of Josephus, a first century Jewish historian. In any case, Rachel was not yet free of her pagan background. And I see in that note, nothing is said of inheritance rights at all. But there are other scholars who feel that that was the significance of it. All right, the background for the situation of Jacob at Peniel and his meeting of God there is Esau had become powerful. And Jacob sends messengers ahead of him to his brother Esau before he arrives back in Canaan. And you notice in verse 4, he instructed them, this is of chapter 32, this is what you are to say to my master. Esau, your servant Jacob says, I have been staying with Laban, have remained there till now. I have cattle, donkeys, sheep, goats, men servants, maid servants. Now I am sending this message to my Lord that I may find favor in your eyes. He calls himself Esau's servant. When the messengers come back, they say, we went to your brother, and now he's coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. And that sounds ominous to Jacob. And so you read in verse 7, in great fear and distress, Jacob divided the people who were with him into two groups. The idea was, I think, if Esau comes and he comes to attack, we'll be in two groups. He won't get all of us. And the flocks and the herds and camels as well. He thought, says, if Esau attacks one group, the group that is left may escape. And then Jacob turns to prayer. And you really have a beautiful prayer in which he claims God's promises and asks for deliverance from Esau. And you find that in verses 9 to 12. He says, O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, go back to your country and your relatives and I will make you prosper. I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan. But now I've become two groups. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau. For I am afraid he will come out and attack me, and also the mothers with their children. But you have said, I will surely make you prosper, and will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted. So he really claims God's promise, and prays for deliverance from what he fears with respect to Esau. And then what he does, as far as his strategy, is to send some people ahead of him with a gift to give to Esau. And it's not a small gift. You look at verse 13. He selected a gift for his brother Esau, 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes, 20 rams, 30 female camels with their young, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys, 10 male donkeys. And then he said, you go on ahead with this gift, but keep space between the herds. He instructed the one in the lead, verse 17, when my brother Esau meets you and asks, to whom do you belong, where you are going, who owns all these animals in front of you, or to say they belong to your servant Jacob, they're a gift. And then you see, you no sooner get that than the second would come along and all the others who followed, and each one was to say the same thing. And he says, verse 20, be sure to say your servant Jacob is coming behind us. For he thought, I will pacify him with these gifts I'm sending on ahead. So perhaps he would be received. So he sent that on ahead. And then in verse 22 you read, Jacob took his two wives, two maidservants, and his 11 sons, crossed the ford of the Jabbok after he'd sent them across. And all his possessions with him. He was left alone. And there you get this rather mysterious incident in which Jacob wrestles with the angel of the Lord and pleads with the Lord for a blessing. And in the course of that, his name is changed from Jacob to Israel. You read that he wrestled with the man till daybreak, and when the man saw he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, let me go, for it's daybreak. Jacob replied, I will not let you go unless you bless me. The man asked him, what is your name? Jacob, he answered. The man said, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel. because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome. Jacob said, please tell me your name. But he replied, why do you ask my name? And he blessed him there. Now, we know that Jacob understood that the one with whom he was wrestling was God himself. So as he says in verse 30, he called the place Peniel, saying, it's because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared. Now, he pleads for God, he pleads with God for a blessing in that encounter. And I think he does that, as is clear in his prayer, on the basis of God's promise. What's the significance of this experience? In Steiger's commentary on Genesis, it's on your bibliography. Page 14, about the middle of the page. Steiger says, up to this point, Jacob has devised strategies for appeasing Esau and returning to the land of promise. But now, just as he is to cross the Jabbok to enter the land, he's prevented by the Lord himself. And Steiger understands this to have this significance. The Lord is showing him who is its rightful owner, that is the land, and the true giver of the land. He's brought to the place where he realizes he cannot enter the land in his own strength and is to receive it only as God gives it to him in accordance with his promises. So Jacob receives it by asking, not by might or by craftiness. Leupold says, Jacob is brought to the point where human devices and carnal ingenuity are no longer equal to the need that has arisen. His own cleverness, on which he has so largely leaned in the past, proves inadequate. Jacob has only the Lord left in this extremity, and he learns in faith, though it costs him a hard struggle, to cast himself wholly and resolutely upon God's mercy alone. But to do so involves an agony of prayer that leaves its mark upon the man. Now, it seems to me that they both touch on the heart of the issue here. Jacob is brought at this point to realize that he is to receive these promises as God gives it in faith, not by his own strategies and ways of trying to bring it to pass himself. So that his name is changed from Jacob, which comes from the root Akav in Hebrew, which means to deceive. It's changed from Jacob to Israel, that comes from the verbal form Sarah, and El. Sarah means contend, El means God. So that the name signifies he who contends with God. And I think in the context, the idea is he who contends with God, and in so doing shows that he realizes that the promises of God are sure. He can't enter the land in his own strength, but he needs to trust in the Lord and in his promises, not in his own devices. So his name is changed to Israel. Question.
Can you at all project what the nature of their discussion was?
You mean between the angel of the Lord with whom he wrestled and Jacob?
Yeah.
Well, I think the heart of it is the end of verse 26. Jacob says, I won't let you go unless you bless me. I think he realized in the context of this encounter, that he was wrestling with God, and the only way he could go back into that land was if God would fulfill those promises and bless him by his grace.
Are you saying that Jacob, just by asking God's protection of his brother, and God holds out test today, it might be really easy.
Well, I think that makes sense. It's a hard narrative to make, you know, it's a very mysterious thing. It's hard to know exactly what's going on. It seems to me that that comes close to it.
I think that Jacob prevailed to suggest that he won the victory, and if God wants to show him that he thought, why did God not make the victory? Wouldn't it make more sense?
Well, he was, you know, touched in his hip, and that became a permanent disability to Jacob. But I don't know. You could say maybe the other way would have been more significant. It's hard, you know, it's hard to answer. I think Jacob realizes in the context that he needs God's help, and he's not going to let God go unless he receives the blessing. There is a, I don't think that throws much light on it either, but Hosea 12, 3 and 4 is an allusion to this. Hosea 12, 3 and 4 says, of Jacob, in the womb he grasped his brother's heel. As a man, he struggled with God. He struggled with the angel and overcame him. He wept and begged for his favor. So he struggled with God and begged for God's favor, even though he did overcome him. Yes.
It refers to, as a man struggled with God, struggled with the angel, and does not have, a lot of people refer to it as Christ.
Well,
the same way as they have with three strangers.
A lot of people, I think that's a hard thing to say with any certainty one way or another. A lot of people speak of this incident, the incident with Abraham, as Christophanies. So that instead of theophany in a more broad general sense, some manifestation of God, these are made equivalent to a pre-incarnate manifestation of the second person of the Trinity, Christ himself. It may be. But it's hard to pin that down.
Come across like it comes out.
Yeah. I think it's possible, but I don't think you can be dogmatic about that. Yes.
Well, I just wanted to of this chapter to the fact that Jacob got the idea of dividing his party into two camps because of the angelic pattern.
Let's see, you're at chapter
32.
Okay. Oh, I see. In other words, how I wouldn't be so sure of that. How close do you connect verse 3 with what's said in verse 1? Jacob went on his way. The angels of God met him. When Jacob saw them, he said, this is the camp of God, so he named that place Mahanaim. Then you read that Jacob sent messenger ahead to his brother Esau, instructed them, this is what you say, so forth. Yeah, it means two camps. Okay. Well, I'm looking at the NIV study note here. You don't have that there. It relates that to what precedes, not what follows. In other words, Mahanaim, located in Gilead, east of the Jordan, north of the Jabbok, two camps had just met in hostility. Laban and Jacob, and separated in peace. Two camps were again about to meet in hostility, Jacob thought, and separate in peace. But Jacob called this crucial place two camps after seeing the angelic encampment, suggesting that he saw God's encampment as a divine assurance. God's host had come to escort him safely to Canaan. Yet he also feared meeting with Esau, so he divided his household into two camps. Still trying to protect himself by his own devices. I don't know that the revelation from the angels would have been something to encourage him to divide into two camps. It seems like he is dividing himself into two camps. And the context is that it's also himself versus Esau, and previously it's been himself versus Laban. So perhaps that's the reason for the name. Yes?
Is there any indication that Jacob played the singular role?
I don't see anything in the text that says that, that he was. It does seem that Jacob's attitude changes, though, in the midst of this experience, from being fearful of Esau to realizing he had to put his trust and his confidence in God. And really then fear God, not Esau. Okay. I guess it's time to stop. We'll pick up here then tomorrow. And continue on with the loss of Joseph and Jacob's blessings. Okay.